How is everybody? It's good to see you. Sunshine decided it was going to show up after all. Told Shauna she had to wear her winter coat because it was looking kind of wintry. So now she doesn't need it necessarily. Today's sermon is a continuation from last week. And if you weren't here last week, I will give you a quick summary of what you missed. Last week, we took a look at the word covenant. And I must apologize because I think I left some people with the idea that a covenant is a promise. That is not actually true. Covenant contains a promise. But from the study of the scriptures and the word diatheke that we looked at last week, we understand that the covenant is actually a will and a testament, a last will and testament. And that Christ has such a will and a testament for his people. Today I would like to take a look at reinforcing that idea. I don't know about you, but I don't always get ideas at the first take. Sometimes it takes some reinforcement. So today's sermon is called The Days That Would Come. And I've never done PowerPoint, so this could be a total disaster, but we'll find out how it goes here. It'll keep me on track. I won't be chasing rabbits anyway, so that's a good thing. And it says it's the execution of the will and covenant of Jesus Christ. Am I doing this right? I hit the wrong button, Keith, sorry. See? I told you it could be a disaster. I'm sorry. Remote controls are confusing to get used to them. I put on the singing, which we're not going to sing again. I'll spare you that.
I think you took it off of the presentation, and you're back on now.
They should put "Don't Touch Dummy" on that button. Are we back? Oh, we're back. Okay.
Right.
There we go. And I can see right now I'm getting old because I'm going to need a bigger font. Anybody else not read that? Sorry. It looked really big on the screen. Like I said, it could be a disaster. The scripture for today is Hebrews 2:1-3, and it says, "Therefore we ought to give more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we should let them slip. For the word spoken by angels was steadfast." This is kind of the underlying portions can be a little scary, and they should be a little scary. They're meant to be a little bit scary. It says, "And every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him?" That's why I'm having the second sermon on the lost will and testament of Jesus, because it's very easy for us to let slip things. We can hear it one time, and I'm assuming that you're similar to myself, and it doesn't always stick. It doesn't always cement in the mind like it should have, because we've been gone through life with a preconceived idea of, as we said last week, that the preconceived idea is that a covenant means that it's some kind of a contract between God and us, when it's not that at all. It's a last will and testament. It's nothing to do with reciprocity. It doesn't mean that God will give me something because I gave him something. It's a completely different concept. So I thought it would be helpful to try and go over some points on this to help fix it in your mind. Now, it was very interesting when I was writing the book, when I got to this section, because the way I wrote the book was knelt down and said, "You want me to write this? I have no idea where to start." And he said, "Well," and it didn't come right away, but after quite a bit of praying, he said, "Well, start here." And I got done that section, I said, "Now where to go? Where do I go?" Back on my knees again. I didn't know where to go. I was like, this is ridiculous. What in the world? Very unbelieving of me, by the way. I don't recommend that response to God. But so it went back and forth, back and forth. And I finished the section on the diatheke. And I was like, "Now where?" And he said, "Well, why don't you take a look at what is legally required to institute a will?" Now, our legal system is based on Roman law. I don't know how many of you knew that, but it's very interesting when you study it, and I won't bore you with the details, but how very closely our legal procedures have come down to us from Roman times. And the Romans, of course, their big boast was they never created anything. They just stole it from everybody else. So this process is very old. It's very, it's got a long antiquity to it. And there is a process that is involved to make a will and testament. How many of you have actually gone in and done one? Okay, so some of these steps will be familiar to you. But it seemed that God is saying, why don't you take a look at the scriptures and see if this process was adhered to by Christ? Now, that would be kind of important, wouldn't it? If it is a will, and the Bible says it's a will, should there not have been some sort of process that he engaged in to establish a will? And so I started to take a look at it, and there are four main ingredients required to make a will, and we'll go through them and take a look and see, did Christ actually meet the requirements of a will? Because if you make a will and it's not binding, is there any point of making it? No, and if you don't do it right, you can't just, you know, pull out a napkin someday at the restaurant and scribble down your will and stick it in the dresser drawer, and when you die, your kids are supposed, you know, that's the courts, that's just not how it's done. There's a procedure for it, okay? And so I'd take a look at it, and it's very important. It's interesting, before we leave our scripture reading, I picked this one, and it is in Hebrews, and Hebrews is probably, as far as I know, the most authoritative book in the Bible on the last will and testament of Jesus Christ, about its making, who it's for, what it contains, when it will be given. All these things are in Hebrews. And it's interesting because we live in a day and age when the grace of God is, if you ask me, it's slightly abused. And you know what I mean by that? It can be, God can be viewed as a different God than he was in the Old Testament. Because the grace of God has become very prominent, and it's almost unbalanced in a way. The grace of God is everything. The cross is everything. Everybody is saved. There's no worries. Everything is good to go. We don't have any problems. But in Hebrews, it says that we should take a very close look at what is to follow through the whole book of Hebrews. This is an injunction is actually repeated at the end of Hebrews. He says, I urge you, brothers and sisters, to pay careful attention to what I wrote to you in this book. It says here that every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward. And we live in a day and age when people seem to think that that's not going to actually be the case anymore, don't we? We do. Jesus died, so there's no recompense for my behavior in the end. Everything's just hunky-dory. But that's not what Paul seems to be saying here. It really isn't. It says, if we neglect so great a salvation, how are we going to escape? In other words, if we're not partakers of the salvation provided by Jesus Christ, every transgression and disobedience is going to receive its just reward, is it not? So it's very important that we don't neglect the salvation that Paul is providing information on or teaching in the book of Hebrews. Is that not a fair assessment of that text? How important is it then that we should understand this? I've had some people say, what does it matter that we know? God will just take care of it. You know, he loves me. He'll work out the details. Why don't I bother with the details? Don't bother me with the details. But that's not what Paul says here, is it? How are you going to escape if you neglect this salvation? Excuse me, this salvation. So anyway, there's more that could be said there, but I will move on. A new covenant and divisory will. In Hebrews 8:8, the Old Testament is quoted. It says, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. This word covenant, as we discovered, was the word diatheke. It means the days come when I will make a new will with the house of Judah, Israel, and with the house of Judah. It's interesting that this word make is the word santaleo in the Greek. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm probably butchering it. But we'll give it a good best shot. And it comes from the word of son and teleo, big surprise. and it means to complete entirely, generally to execute, literally or figuratively, end, finish, fulfill, or make. Now, when we make a will in our day and age, the legal term for it is the execution of a will. It has nothing to do with putting it to death. It actually has to do with executing it or bringing it into being, okay? And this word make means that the days will come, says the Lord, when I will execute a new will. And I'm not going to go into what follows. In a future talk, we can look at that. It says that the days were coming, and the days that were to come, what days were they? I asked that question. And it's interesting because Daniel 9:27 says something very similar. It's very interesting how closely it follows it, and it says, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. This text has rightfully been used for showing that Jesus Christ is the Messiah predicted by God in the Bible. It's a wonderful prophecy. But generally, we skip over this idea of to confirm a covenant. Now, this word confirm is a word that means to strengthen, make strong, etc. And it's almost the same thing as the word make that we find in Hebrews. Now, to establish a covenant, to make it strong, there are some things that need to be done. There's a legal process required. And those of you who have been there know what that legal process is. And it's very important that it's done correctly. If it's not done correctly, some unscrupulous lawyer, we were having jokes about lawyers. If there's lawyers here, I apologize. If there are lawyers here, I apologize that are watching, that might be watching. You know, they probably know the lawyer jokes. There are some pretty good ones. But unless a will is established on a legal basis, it has the possibility of being overturned. And if there a possibility exists of it being overturned, what confidence do the heirs named in that will have? Have you ever been or heard of or known anyone that got into a will that was disputed? Anybody? It's traumatic for the heirs if you think that someone's going to come in and take away, you know, what has been left to you by your loved one. It can be very traumatic, and so Christ doesn't want to leave us in any doubt about the validity of His will, and so He has gone to great lengths to make sure that it's rock solid, ironclad, and unchangeable. And He has done that so that we might have great confidence in it, okay? And it's interesting that the more closely that the process is adhered to, the stronger the will becomes. The more instances of evidence, and we're going to be looking at some of these requirements, but the more evidence there is, the stronger the case becomes that the will cannot be changed. And we have an adversary that is greater than any adversary you can imagine, don't we? He's more crafty than any of the creatures God has ever made. It's aptly that He used the serpent in Eden, wasn't it? It was very apt. But he is a very strong and powerful enemy, and with a lot of very persuasive and devious arguments. And so Christ gave us many instances to prove that the establishment of His covenant, His will, is legally binding, and we can have every confidence that it will be carried out. So I'd like to take a look at them. The first step in instituting a will is the testamentary intent and testamentary capacity must be proven. Now that's a jawful. That's just lawyer speak. That's saying first of, you know, that the let's take a look at it point by point. The following proceedings has to be shown that the following proceedings are taking place to legally establish the individual's wishes regarding their property after their death. It also has to. It includes they have to express their intention of making a will. In other words, you can't just take Great Aunt Bethel out sometime somewhere to dinner, hand her a little piece of paper and say, hey, you know, why don't you go ahead and sign that there up? And she doesn't know what she's doing. The judge's like, no, that's not how it works. And they must be found mentally capable of doing so, or sound mind and body, in other words. Okay, you've all heard that term. That one's very common term. So as to testamentary intent, did Christ know that He was executing a will? It's funny, when I asked that question of myself when I was researching this, it's like, I sure hope He knew, because I never knew. I was like, I didn't know He was doing that. But you remember that at the Last Supper with His disciples, Christ said some very interesting things to them. He said, "This is the cup of the New Testament in my blood." That word testament is, like as we said last week, that is the same word diatheke that means will, okay? This blood, this is the blood of the new will in my, this cup is the blood of the new will in my testament. This do ye as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. Did he know that his death would give something to his children? In other words, when you go to make a will, you got to know you have something to give them, right? Otherwise, what's the point? I leave nothing to nobody. Well, that was an exercise in futility. He did. He did. And if you read the scriptures there in Matthew 26, 27, and 28, you find out that he knew that by the execution of this will, he would bring about the remissions of sins for many. There was this, that was the stated point, the stated aim of his making this covenant or will, as it were. So he knew what he was doing. And there's many more examples. I had to rein myself in because we only have a finite amount of time here. There's many more examples and there's in the book. Testamentary capacity. Was Christ of a sound mind and body? When I was a kid, you know, you guys all listened to the Bible stories, most of you, right, growing up? You know what one of my favorite sections of those Bible stories was? It was when Jesus sat down in the temple and he said, "Bring it." He didn't really say that, but you know what I mean. All of the Sadducees, there's a terrible showdown at the end, okay? For most of his ministry, he had spent it among the poor, humble classes, but finally he went to Jerusalem and there was a temple showdown. And it featured the Herodians. Who were the Herodians, by the way? They were supporters of Herod, okay? And it featured the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and I'm not going to go into all the questions that were there, but it said when it was all over, that when it was done, no man was able to answer him a word. Neither durst any man from that day forward ask him any more questions. He was sharp as a tack. He took, and you got to remember who he was up against here. These were the most subtle and educated religious and legal minds in the nation. And this is in a nation that was above every other nation when it came to law keeping, right? But when it was all over, he sprung every trap they set for him. He defused every bomb and he left them without a word to say to him. It just, when I read it or when I heard it as a kid, it just made me want to go, yeah, right? Just, yeah, because they were gunning for him, weren't they? And he just walked through there and then he laid a few real doozies on them in return. You know, it's amazing. He was sharp as a tack. There was nothing wrong with his mental capacity. So does he qualify as mentally capable of executing a will? He does. There's another thing too, as much as it's been used as a anti-alcohol lesson, at the cross, you remember what happened when he said, "I thirst." What happened? They took a sponge, they dipped it into this stupefying alcoholic kind of concoction that they used, a mild anesthetic, I guess we call it. And they offered it to him, and he didn't take it. And see, children, you shouldn't drink. And children, you shouldn't drink. But that wasn't the main reason that he refused it. If he had taken that, it could be argued that when he signed the will, which we'll get to in a minute, when he signed the will, that he wasn't really in his right mind. Couldn't that be argued? That he was kind of, you know, he just kind of got a little foggy-headed there, and he didn't know what he was doing. But he said, "No, I'm not even going to take any anesthetic for this pain. I am going to take it all so no one can say I didn't know what I was doing." He intentionally did it. It wasn't just as a anti-drinking, lesson for us. So Christ was. He was capable. He intended to write a will. He was capable of it. And now step two is the absence of fraud and undue influence. This one's very important, okay? Very, very important. It's interesting because there's evidence in the scriptures that this happened on two levels. One, in heaven, and two, on earth. And there's numerous examples, but I only picked the one for heaven. It says, "Who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men, and being found in the fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. God knew what he was doing. God wasn't, hey, I'm going to go down there and help these people out and we'll see what happens. No, he knew what was going to happen. He went there, he left his father's throne, and importantly, his father sent him. That would have been hard if you're a father to send your child, one you love, you know, more than anything, to a world, or you, especially knowing as God does what was going to happen. He went into this thing with his eyes wide open, in other words. That's the aspect of it from the divine portion of it. The other question is, when Christ had come into the world, could he have refused the cross? Now, it's a pretty easy question to answer, but I'd like to take a few verses and take a look at them just to refresh your memory. It says, therefore does my Father love me, because I lay down, and he's speaking to his disciples. This is recorded by John. This, therefore doth my Father love me, because I lay down my life that I might take it again. No man taketh it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. No one killed Jesus. Nobody killed him. He voluntarily laid it down. He could have said, no, I'm not executing this will. Not going to do it. Not going to do it. It's not happening. But he did. He had opportunities to escape. They weren't just, if you wondered, why the angel? You know, that's great to see that those baddies got knocked on their fannies. But what was is that all it was about? Is just to show, you know, that he could have escaped. We all know that if we believe that he is the Son of God, that he could have escaped. First of all, he knew he was going to be betrayed. And if you knew you were going to be betrayed, you say you're coming to a board meeting, and they're going to call the cops on you at board meeting. What's the chances are you wouldn't go to board meeting? Pretty high, right? It's like, no, I'm unwise to you. I'm not going. He knew. He could have just left town, couldn't he? Sure he could have. Did he? No, in fact, he told his disciples, I'm going to be betrayed. In fact, he knew it before he even got to Jerusalem, didn't he? He could have refused the cup in the garden. You remember that thrice-echoed prayer, that agonizing prayer that he prayed? Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. This cup, this death, this execution that was coming, please let it pass from me. Three times. Three times that prayer was wrung from him. And yet he stayed firm to his resolution to do it. And he could have walked away when this angel came, right? You remember the story. The mob comes. Judas kisses him. Hail, Master. You know, it's a beautiful response of love to his betrayer. And this angel shows up. They all fall like dead men. He could have walked off into the night. He could have walked off into the night. Nobody forced him. That's the point of this. There was no coercion. There was no arm twisting. You remember what happened when Peter got his sword out and started flinging it about in a most unskillful, unworkmanlike manner, and all he had managed to do was lop off an ear? What did Christ tell him? Put your sword away. Don't you think I could now ask my Father and he would send me more than 12 legions of angels? There was no coercion. No coercion in the death of Christ. There was no coercion in the cross. He went there on purpose. And what did he tell his disciples that purpose was? Was to establish a new diatheke so that many could have their sins remitted. A new will. He knew what he was doing. Nobody forced him. So there's our second one. Anybody find any objections to the validity of this will yet? I can't see any. And I've only touched a few of them. When I started to see this, I was just like giggly. I hate to admit that, but I was. I was like, man, you got to be kidding me. I'd go over to the house, Shauna, you won't believe this. And she's like, yeah, well, again, what now? Right? But it was really neat and very, very amazing. Step three, though, is a signature of the testator. It says, Jesus, this is an interesting verse from Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 20 and 21. It says, Jesus is the great shepherd of the sheep. by an everlasting diatheke, or will, signed with what? With his blood. To him be glory forever and ever. Amen. The signature of the witness, or of the testator, pardon me, is the third step in ratifying and making an ironclad will. And that step is indispensable. Now, what do you do with an illiterate person? Do you guys, anybody ever studied the practices in England, especially in areas where it came to legal documents for illiterate people? You may have seen it in an old movie. The person's illiterate. They come up, the cowhand comes up to sign on at the dude ranch, you know, and he's, I can't sign your name right here. And the guy says, I can't write. So we'll make your mark. And what do? Put down an X, right? You guys have seen that, correct? Well, the courts, when it comes to what is allowed as a valid signature, there is one principle that overwhelmingly trumps everything else, and that is the intention of the testator, or the one making the will. What was their intention? And the court allows a very broad range of methods to certify that they were intending to sign. Everything from an X to a verbal, and sometimes in the case of those who can't speak, the nodding of the head even will work. Okay. The important thing is that the judge is satisfied that they intended to sign that will. It doesn't have to have, you know, your John Henry with a ballpoint pen. The intention is what is important. The intent to sign. Did Christ intend to sign his will with his blood? How can you tell if someone is intent on something? What's a good way? Well, first of all, if you want to find out a real good example of it, tell your child they can't do something that they really, really want to do. Isn't it their actions that show their intention? It really is, isn't it? And actions are a really great way to decide if someone intends something or not, correct? You know, if you really, really, really want that bike, you will work and work and work until you get it, right? If that's your intention, it is shown in your actions, is I guess my point. And it's interesting when we look at Christ signing the will, because anybody remember that Bible story where Jesus sat down in the temple back in the back corner with a couple of scribes and scribbled down on the paper his last will and testament? Do you remember that story? Yeah, me neither. So where and when and how was it that Christ signed a will? Well, it says, and the people stood beholding, this is from Luke 23:35. I have really got to get a bigger font. And the rulers also with them derided him, saying, he saved others, let him save himself, if he be Christ, the chosen of God. So they're mocking him, baiting him. Now, it's a cruel thing to say, right? And we're told by the spirit of prophecy that the devil and his angels in human form were around that cross, and that they were inspiring the crowd with their own sentiments and attitudes. What is this other than a temptation? Is it not a temptation? Because could Christ have come down? Could he have ended the execution? It's a very interesting double word there. It's really cool. He could have come down. Absolutely. What he had said to Peter before still held true, did it not? 12 legions of angels. I mean, you remember what the tomb, when one angel came down, what happened to those 100 soldiers? Again, like dead men. It was a temptation, come down from the cross. If he had not intended to execute this will, which he told his disciples that he was going to execute, if he had not intended it, would he have come down? If he had not, certainly he would have. He would have come down from the cross if it wasn't his intention to execute this will, wouldn't he have? But it was his intention to execute it. And so we can see that fact by the fact that he stayed on the cross when he could have come down. What were his intentions? What were they? They were to see this thing through, weren't they? And it goes on. It says, in the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. Now, this is on an emotional level. The other was on a physical level, the come down, right? But there was another and greater, far greater, I would say, component to the sufferings of Jesus. Everybody seems to, not everybody, many seem to focus on the physical suffering, the whipping, the scourging, the crown of thorns, the nails, right? They all, that pain, that physical pain, but there was a pain far more acute, far more acute. He says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which being interpreted is my God, why have you forsaken me? That was the deepest wound. That was the wound that broke his heart. The separation of the Son of God from his Father. If he had not intended to carry this execution of the will through, he would have left that cross. And we can look back to the garden as well, because it's the same thing. Did Jesus intend to do what he did? It would have taken the most intense intention. This is a signing of his will with blood. He carried it through. He carried it out. Any judge looking at that would say, yeah, he really intended to do what he did. He did. For love, for you, and miserable me. It boggles the mind that the God of the universe would do something like that. And the suffering, not to say nothing of the sufferings of the Father and the Spirit. Step four, the last step, is a signature of the witnesses. Wills must be witnessed. How many of you had witnesses at the signing of your wills? Right? Okay. In Roman times, there was a requirement of a minimum of four witnesses. Minimum. Minimum of four witnesses. And the signing by the witnesses had to be in public at an assembly of the people, which is interesting. Oh, I'm going down a rabbit trail, but I'll just go a little ways because it's a cool point. When did Christ's sacrifice take place? When did he enact this testament? What time of the year was it? It was Passover, was it not? Who was there? People from every corner of the world were there. It couldn't get more public. It couldn't get more public. To make a legally binding will, though, it requires the signing of witnesses. It must be witnessed by others. They must make and sign statements that they saw the testator, the one executing the will, comply with the three previous steps. Did Christ have such a thing? The Gospels are a story of what? They're the story of Jesus, are they not? That's specifically what they are. The Gospels are written witnesses of what happened. They are testimonies to the execution of the will or covenant of Christ, and they are the disciples' affidavits. Now, what's an affidavit? I got a handy definition there for you. Really hard to read. The irony is I left my glasses that I can read far away at home thinking, I don't need those. Anyway, I know better. Affidavit. It's a declaration upon oath. More generally, a declaration in writing signed by the party and sworn to before an authorized magistrate. That's an affidavit. It's a legal document that says, I personally saw what is contained in this document. Were there witnesses? There were. All 12 of the disciples were witnesses. It's very interesting, another little tiny rabbit trail again. You remember when after Christ was raised from the dead and the Holy Spirit had come down and the disciples said, hey, listen, we need to choose another disciple because Judas had hung himself, right? He betrayed him. And it's very interesting. They found two candidates. And do you remember what it was that distinguished those two candidates from all the rest? It wasn't their zeal or piety. What was it? That's right. They said, there's only two that have seen everything from the beginning. It's important that a witness has a thorough understanding and witness completely what happened. And Jesus said to the disciples, and you shall be my what? Witnesses, both in Jerusalem and in Judea and to the ends of the earth. And the Gospels were written as their testimony. Now, what about the signature? Let me go back here. What about the signature by the witnesses? Do you see any big flourishing signature at the end of the book of Matthew? Not really. Mark? No. Luke? John? Not really. Not as we would constitute it. But their signatures, I would argue, are the same as their master's. How many, don't have to put up your hands, but I know many of us have told lies. I was a terrible liar when I was a kid. It was a besetting sin of mine. And I had this bad habit of making a bad situation or position worse. Nobody else here, I'm sure, has ever done that. By trying to tell lies to support the lies. Right? But my mother was very keen that my lying tongue should be stilled. Thank God. And the deeper I dug the hole, the higher the pressure got. And I always reached a point where my somewhat pragmatical mind would say, all right, I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze anymore. Right? Because all I'm doing is storing up wrath against wrath here. I'd better admit it and just take my lumps. You know, there always gets to be a point where the liar will not support the lie anymore. When it becomes a profit loss, the profit loss balance goes out of whack, they will always admit, I was lying. That's just how it works. What about the disciples? What happened to them? All 12 of them, tradition tells us, all except for John, okay? All 12 of them did not live out their days in peaceful bliss and dignified prosperity, did they? They were all put to death. Why were they put to death? Because of their witness about Christ. And their deaths were their signature that what they saw was true. There's no stronger evidence than their willingness to die for what they had seen and heard. And John himself, in fact, I think John's the biggest hero of the bunch, is he didn't get put to death. He was sentenced to a life imprisonment in a terrible place. They tried to kill him, if tradition is to be believed, by boiling him in oil. That didn't work because God had more work for him to do. And so they sent him to Patmos. Do you think he could have left Patmos? I think he could have. Personally, I don't have any evidence for it, but I have this feeling that if he had gone and denied Christ, they would have probably let him go, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if that carrot was dangled. Because the devil wants nothing more than for us to deny Christ, right? But each and every one of those men died for their faith in Jesus. They died rather than give up the truth of what they saw. So, the four steps, have they been implemented in the will of Jesus Christ? All four of them. And I didn't even... You can go, if it's a real fun exercise, you can go and really start looking. And it's just everywhere you look. I haven't even touched upon having to have something to give someone. That might be an interesting topic. What did Christ have to give? It said the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So he wasn't giving wealth in a physical sense, was he? But that has to do with what is in the will. All I've done is show that there is one. That the scriptures plainly teach that Christ has written and left a will of disposition for his children. The cross of Christ stands there as a testimony that the will of Christ has been ratified and that the promises of God, the promises God made in that will, are sure to be implemented. It's important that we have the confidence that what God has promised us, we will receive. What is faith? It's the confident assurance that what God has promised, he will deliver. And it's evidence of things that can't be seen. That's what Hebrews 11 says. That confidence in him. The cross stands there. It's interesting that a will does not actually go in force. I didn't put it in as a fifth step, but I suppose I could have. If you want a fifth step in making sure a will is ironclad, unchangeable, rock solid, it requires one more thing. The death of the one who wrote it. A will does not go into effect until the one who wrote it is proved to have died. It's a beautiful thing, because if you look at the cross, there hangs Christ. Sabbath is coming on. The priests go to Pilate and say, hey, we've got to kill these guys. They can't hang there on the cross over the Sabbath. It'll defile the Sabbath. We want permission to kill them. He says, all right, go ahead and break their legs. I assume to cause death from suffocation. That's what I've heard. That's what makes the most sense to me. I've heard people say, well, they broke their legs so they wouldn't run away on Sabbath. But that doesn't make any sense, because they asked to hasten their death, not to impede their mobility. Okay? And so when the soldiers came to the first thief and they broke his legs, then they broke the legs of the second thief. They came to Christ and they said, oh, he's dead already. We don't need to break his legs. And there's a beautiful text, right? He shall leave none of his bones shall be broken, right? Beautiful things like that. But they come to Christ and it's, no, he's already dead. And here the priests and rulers unwittingly played a part that's very vital in the establishment of a solid will. They said, oh, well, no, he's not dead. And the soldier said, okay. They said, take your spear and drive it up through his side, into his heart. You're not going to survive that. Are you? No. And it says that when the soldier thrust that spear into the side of Jesus, what came out? Blood and water. And this is a really neat thing. This one gave me chills when I realized it. It says that when all of the tabernacle services, let me just read it to you. For when it says in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 19, for when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, in other words, when the covenant had been read and the people knew what was in it and they had seen the process required to make it, it says that he took the blood of calves, of goats, and what else? And water. And he sprinkled it and he said, this blood and this water confirms the covenant that God has made with you. And the last act in this drama, the last act required to make this will binding and absolutely unassailable and unchangeable, was the death of the testator. The death of Jesus. And God, way back in the time of Moses, knew what was going to come out of that wounded side. He knew that his son would die of a broken heart, and so he had Moses take blood and water and establish the first covenant so that it was binding. And the real covenant was established by blood and water as well, by the death of the testator. And the cross stands there. And it witnesses that God has created and written and established a will that is unchangeable. And it doesn't matter when you have a rock solid will who assails it. The wishes of the testator are carried out if it isn't overthrown without deviation. And that's a beautiful thing for God's people, because we can know that the will that Christ wrote, implemented, and signed with his blood is unchanging. We can have every confidence in it. It still remains to discover what that is. What is it is contained in that will? What is it that God has left? And when we get it? All very important questions. Wouldn't you agree? They're very important to me. But the cross stands there saying this will is established and it's not changeable. I will give to my children, and that's an important point, to those who are found to be my children, I will give them their inheritance. And there is nothing that the devil or hell can do about it, because it is going to happen. Sure thing. It can't be changed anymore. And so I hope that this helps, this examination of these steps required and their application of that from the life of Christ helps to solidify in your mind that a covenant is not a contract of give and take between God and man, but it is a will and testament and that his children will receive their inheritance. Who those children are might be the subject for the next talk. How do you tell? How do you tell if someone is or is not a real child of God? It's a vitally important question, right? These things, I know it's taking a while to get through them, but our scripture text says that we should give diligent heed to these things, right? It's very important. There is only one way to escape from the curse that is sin, and that is through Jesus Christ and no one else. Not through yourself, not through anybody else, but through him alone. And it's very important that we understand these things. So until we talk about this again, may God bless you and keep you. There is a promise. There's a promise in 2 Timothy, and I'd like to read it just before we sing our hymn. But it has something to do with our hymn. It says, henceforth, this is Paul speaking, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me on that day, and not to me only, but to all them that love his appearance. The cross has provided the crown. And as we sing, I know it's an old favorite, the old rugged cross. I hope that every one of us will exchange it someday for that crown of righteousness. God bless you.